listeners, welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Well, here we are, 3 weeks into the new year, and I wanted to check in with you. How are those resolutions coming? Diet and exercise, business, finance? I bet, like all of us, these were on your improvement list. And just maybe you're not as far along as you'd hoped. No worries, we strive for progress, not perfection. I'm here to help. Today's show will focus on titles to help you get moving, striding confidently along the path of self-improvement. Say no to procrastination. As I say, let's turn to page one of the book report. What if charisma could be taught? In the charisma myth, How Anyone Can Master the Art and Science of Personal Magnetism, author Olivia Fox Caban applies science and technology to take charisma apart, figure it out, and turn it into an applied science. The result is akin to practical magic. Unique knowledge, drawn from a variety of sciences, reveal what charisma really is and how it works. Mixing entertaining stories and practical tools, the author takes a scientific approach to an almost mystical topic, covering what charisma is, how it is learned, and how to maximize it. Lisa Cordiglione narrates.
In the torrid London summer of 1886, William Gladstone was up against Benjamin Disraeli for the post of Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. This was the Victorian era, so whoever won was going to rule half the world. In the very last week before the election, both men happened to take the same young woman out to dinner. Naturally, the press asked her what impressions the rivals had made. She said, "After dining with Mr. Gladstone, I thought he was the cleverest person in England. But after dining with Mr. Disraeli, I thought I was the cleverest person in England." Guess who won the election? It was the man who made others feel intelligent, impressive, and fascinating. Benjamin Disraeli. Consciously or not, charismatic individuals choose specific behaviors that make other people feel a certain way. These behaviors can be learned and perfected by anyone. In fact, in controlled laboratory experiments, researchers were able to raise and lower people's levels of charisma as if they were turning a dial. Contrary to commonly held charisma myths, you don't have to be naturally outgoing, you don't have to be physically attractive, and you won't have to change your personality. No matter where you're starting from, you can significantly increase your personal charisma and reap the rewards both in business and in daily life. The most common charisma myth is that you have to be naturally boisterous or outgoing to be charismatic. One of the most interesting research findings is that you can be a very charismatic introvert. In Western society, we place as much emphasis on the skills and abilities of extroverts that introverts can end up feeling defective and uncool. But introversion is not a terminal handicap. In fact, as we'll see, it can be a strong advantage for certain forms of charisma. It is also a myth that you have to be attractive to be charismatic. Countless charismatic figures were far from fitting classic standards of beauty. Churchill was not generally considered handsome, and certainly not known for his sex appeal. And yet, he was one of history's most influential and powerful leaders. Yes, good looks do confer some advantage, but it's very possible to be charismatic without a striking face or figure. In fact, charisma itself will make you more attractive. When instructed to exhibit specific charismatic behaviors in controlled experiments, participants' levels of attractiveness were rated significantly higher than before. Last but not least, you won't have to change your personality. In order to become more charismatic, you don't have to force yourself into one particular personality style or do something that is against your nature. Instead, you will learn some new skills. Through charisma training, you will learn how to adopt a charismatic posture, how to warm up your eye contact, and how to modulate your voice in ways that make people pay attention. 3 quick tips to gain an instant charisma boost in conversation. Lower the intonation of your voice at the end of your sentences. Reduce how quickly and how often you nod. Pause for 2 full seconds before you speak. As you can see, these are simple tweaks, not deep value changes. Your personality will stay the same as long as you want it to. Will these new skills and behaviors feel odd at first? They may. But then, so did brushing your teeth when you first learned how. Though now, I hope, it's become a habit you perform each day without thinking. Like many new skills, charismatic behaviors might feel awkward at first. But with practice, they will become second nature, like walking, talking, or driving. This book is your step-by-step guide to acquiring these behaviors and making them your own.
We've just heard The Charisma Myth by Olivia Fox Caban. Foodist, using real food and real science to lose weight without dieting, is a manifesto that proves, once and for all, that sustainable weight loss is possible by incorporating fresh, seasonal ingredients into every meal. Dieting is a popular hobby in the 21st century, and sadly for most of us, the result is typically a slow but steady weight gain. Oops. Diets fail because they rely on willpower and restriction for achieving health goals and ignore the reasons these tactics always backfire. Author Daria Pino Rose asserts that becoming a foodist helps you give up dieting forever and practice healthy, lasting weight control. Foodist takes you through nutrition and psychology to move you beyond daily obstacles and bad habits. Losing weight need not be about sacrifice and deprivation. Smart, accessible, and engaging, Foodist helps tailor your eating habits to match your lifestyle. The author narrates.
In retrospect, the most interesting part is not that I tried all these diets. Clearly, I was not alone in my efforts. But that I was good at them. I was very thin, i.e. successful, on my low-fat regimen in high school. I was a ballerina and definitely looked the part. After I stopped dancing and put some weight back on, I had no trouble abandoning bread, rice, and potatoes for several years while I got back down to a size zero on the Atkins diet. I gladly woke up at 5 a.m. for two-hour workouts every weekday and clocked three-hour long runs every Sunday for marathon training during my first few years of graduate school. Though my successes may have been fleeting, a weak will has never been the reason. The problem wasn't me. The problem was that starving yourself of energy, nutrients, and pleasure is not the most effective way to attain, let alone maintain, the body you want. It is also no way to live your life. Chronic dieters believe that success comes from sacrifice. If only we could deprive ourselves a little more, punish our bodies even harder, then we could finally look amazing and, of course, be happy. But as someone who has tortured herself in every way imaginable, I can guarantee you that this path does not lead to happiness. Why? Because it turns life into a constant struggle. You never really win if you're dieting. When you are constantly depriving yourself, happiness is always just out of reach. So even if you could confidently identify the best, most effective restrictive diet, why should this be your goal? Shouldn't there be more to life than constantly denying yourself the things you enjoy? Now you're thinking like a foodist. As simple and logical as this sounds, I know from experience that ending deprivation is tough for chronic dieters. No pain, no gain is fundamental to our psyche. Don't we deserve to suffer for being so fat? Most of us have been victims of a vicious, convoluted feedback loop through which we are rewarded for our sacrifices with temporary, but often dramatic, weight loss at the beginning of each new diet. This creates the illusion of success. But you have to ask yourself, shouldn't real success be defined by lasting, not temporary, weight loss? Nutritionists and MDs haven't helped much either. Virtually all weight loss experts tell us we need to eat less and move more to lose weight, with the obvious implication being that we need to diet, deprive ourselves, and exercise, suffer at the gym, to achieve our goals. You can't break the first law of thermodynamics. It's science. But this line of thinking neglects the reasons we are compelled to overeat in the first place and doesn't give us the tools we need to actually implement their simple eat less, move more, lose weight equation. It also implies that failure stems from a lack of willpower. Why aren't you eating less like you're supposed to? Rather than from a plan that fails to account for the nuances of the human psyche. How many people do you know who eat solely for fuel? All the thin people, right? Not a chance. Sure, we all sometimes eat because we're hungry, but the specific foods we choose and how much we eat are largely influenced by our habits and environment. In other words, it is not the concept of eating less to lose weight that is wrong, but the idea that we can lose weight and keep it off without accounting for why we make the choices we do.
That was Foodist by Daria Pino Rose. Born a perfect lady in an imperfect society, Miss Manners, aka Judith Martin, is the pioneer of today's civility movement. Her tireless efforts to expand the understanding and exercise of etiquette have not escaped official notice. During a White House ceremony in November 2005, Judith was awarded the nation's highest honor in the humanities, the National Humanities Medal, in recognition of her contributions to society as America's foremost etiquette columnist and author. Since 1978, Judith's Miss Manners newspaper columns have been carried in more than 200 newspapers in the U.S. and abroad. In her books and columns, Miss Manners deals with complicated aspects of life, romance, work, family relationships, child rearing, death, as well as philosophical and moral dilemmas. The New York Times declares Martin's work an impassioned plea for a return to civilized behavior, while Newsday says she is a philosopher cleverly and charmingly disguised as an etiquette columnist. Time magazine stated, Martin has helped transform etiquette from the realm of society matrons to tools for everyday life. One of her recent books was Miss Manners' Guide to a Surprisingly Dignified Wedding, co-authored with her daughter. It's a manifesto against today's monster weddings, and she explains how to plan nuptials that are charming, affordable, and correct. Now Miss Manners has written Minding Your Business with her son, Nicholas Ivor Martin, director of operations at the Lyric Opera of Chicago and author of the DiCapo Opera Manual. Let's discuss the Minding Your Business with her now. Welcome, Judith. I am so thrilled to have you as a guest on the Book Report.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here.
Why did you feel the time was right for a book on business etiquette?
Well, as you know, I've been dealing for a long time with rudenesses of all kinds, but this was something slightly different, misapplied manners, people using their social manners in their business lives and their business manners in their social lives. And that was a kind of a new wrinkle, but I began to notice it from the problems that people report to me. They are pressured to celebrate birthdays and give showers at work and to drink with people afterwards and play games during work hours and so on. And in their private lives, they are, well, if they're looking for romance, they take out a classified ad and do some quick interviews. They think nothing of blowing off people's weddings or other events, saying I have to work. But at the same time, if they're constantly being interrupted for social things at the office, they ask me, well, what can I say? And they don't to get out of it, and they never think of saying I have work to do.
That leads me to a question I've always wanted to ask you. If you're having a private party, whether it's at your home or an event, and you're inviting a high proportion of office colleagues, must you invite the entire office?
On what basis did you select them? If you are really friends, aside from being colleagues, with some of the people at the office, by all means invite them. You don't have to invite the rest. But if it's a professional party, a gathering of some kind, you invite the people to whom this particular work is relevant. But I think you're talking about a kind of hybrid thing where, oh, you kind of like some of them and you don't like others. Why make that clear to them?
I see.
In an interview, how should one deal with questions that seem more personal than professional? For example, the always hideous question, what is your worst fault?
Oh, you always say your worst fault is that you work too hard.
Right.
You just can't let go until you've done something right. It's such a silly question because nobody's going to say, well, I go around purloining other people's lunches or anything that is detrimental, so it might as well not be asked.
In a cubicle office situation, is there a correct way to deal with a noisy neighbor, whether their personal conversations, talking with other colleagues, gum chewing?
And all kinds of other disgusting habits that people report to me all the time. You can't go around criticizing your colleagues face to face, but you can make the person who is in a supervisory position and therefore paid more to do it. And if that person is wise, what he or she will do is put out a general statement. We're having a problem with the noise level. Would people please keep it down? Or we're having a hygiene problem. There have been a lot of complaints about people. Please check that you're not in violation of normal standards, and so on.
Hmm. How do you deal with a business colleague who is texting or answering an email while you're standing in front of them speaking with them?
Well, I would say, presuming that's not your boss, which, because that's a whole other thing, of how do you humor your boss, you say, why don't we talk when you're free, and walk away.
Oh, I like that. And what about other colleagues texting while in a meeting?
That's something that the chairman of the meeting or whoever is conducting the meeting ought to set a standard about. Some people don't mind. And, of course, you don't know what they're doing if they can use their phones or their iPads. And they may be texting, they may be playing games, they may be shopping, who knows. But they may be taking notes about what's going on in the meeting, which will be very useful. So there ought to be a policy. Either you allow these things at a meeting or you don't.
Do you think that the college graduates entering the workforce, do you think they have been instructed enough in etiquette and manners by their parents?
I know they haven't because they come to me for instruction.
So how can they catch up? What should they do?
Well, to be aware that there are different contexts, for different manners for different contexts. That's the first big step, and then you learn what they are, depending on what you're after. But if you're wanting a career in fashion, maybe you should showcase your style, but not if you want a career in the law. So the idea that you have several sets of manners and that this is not hypocrisy, it's just it's complications of society and it makes it life interesting, has kind of been lost. And that's the first thing they need to learn.
I'm sure many of our listeners are wondering how you became this manners.
Well, it's a little bit like Napoleon. You have to crown yourself because there's no one else authorized to do it.
And can you tell us a little bit
more? Well, so I did it. I did it, actually. I was a film and drama critic at the time, and I was just doing this on the side, which it's not unrelated to drama criticism, to amuse myself, and somehow it seems to have filled a need.
Well, now you've written a book with your daughter and one with your son. What has the collaborative process been like for you?
Oh, I love it. Now, mind you, these people were very well brought up, so I don't have problems with them. It's been exciting and fun, and they bring a lot to it. And they're also both now contributing to the column.
Oh.
They have their own careers, full-time, day and night careers of their own, but they wanted to get involved in the column, and I'm delighted.
As someone who has so much experience in the field, do you think our legislators are showing the proper amount of etiquette in the Congress?
You're joking, aren't you?
I I feel like you. We're all just so disappointed.
There are very strict etiquette rules for legislatures, and they don't obey them. You're supposed to not make anything personal. There's convoluted language to avoid that. You say, "I'm afraid the distinguished gentleman from wherever is sadly mistaken," instead of just looking him in the eye and screaming your line. But they've been putting that aside. And unfortunately, every once in a while, they try to fix it. And what they come up with is cronyism. They say, oh, let's all get to be friends. They go on retreats together and so on. Doesn't work, of course. But if it did work, it would be cronyism. The real fix should come at the ballot box. People who complain about how Congress behaves, and they often do to me because I'm a Washingtonian, and we're not responsible for that. We don't have representation in the same way. And they say, what can we do about it? And I say, it's called an election. Don't vote for people who are being rude and contentious and say that they can't possibly deal with people who don't agree with them, because we have a cooperative form of government.
Well, I think it's time for you to write the manifesto for them. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. The book was really wonderful to read.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And now let's hear a sampling of Miss Manners Minds Your Business, narrated by Karen Saltis.
When the deterioration of business manners finally became too serious a problem to ignore, the professional world took one look at the problem and began shredding documents. While Miss Manners appreciates the fact that business has stopped ridiculing etiquette and admitted its legitimacy, this was not a courageous approach. First to go was the purpose of good business manners. Miss Manners had thought that business manners existed to maintain personal dignity and to show respect for others while recognizing hierarchical privilege. To maintain a pleasant demeanor without invading others' privacy. To balance competitiveness with cooperation. To take responsibility but remain flexible. To be both attentive and discreet. And to combine honesty and tact. Instead, she was told that manners existed to dominate one's coworkers or to get rich. Good business manners, being edited, with a nearsighted eye on the bottom line. Not to be manners at all, but simply good business. And then the rules themselves went into the shredder, engulfed by almost universal agreement that there should be no difference between professional manners and personal manners. The relentless drive toward a less formal and less structured workplace resulted in the illusion that it was not work at all. If you did not have to wear a suit to the office, the reasoning went, it would not seem like work. If the boss throws a birthday party for you in the conference room, you will think of him not as your boss, but as your friend.
That was Miss Manners Minds Your Business by Judith Martin and Nicholas Ivor Martin. Megan Doherty is a Brooklyn-based illustrator and designer whose work has appeared in books, websites, and posters. She's just written a very funny book about a serious subject sorely ignored in these times, etiquette. She's filled it with drawings of our childhood pals, Dick and Jane, and one of them figures prominently in the title, How Not to Be a Bleep, an Everyday Etiquette Guide. Let's find out more. Welcome, Megan, and thanks for stopping by the book report. Welcome, Megan, and thanks for stopping by the book report.
Thank you guys for having me.
Your book has a funny title, but it actually deals with the serious subject of being considerate to others. You cover everything from bathroom etiquette to proper language in office emails. What was your impetus to write the book?
It's actually funny. I had a boss that was slightly passive-aggressive, and it made it a little difficult to work. And I was actually pitching a different book at the time, and I came home and I emailed my editor at Just Books. I'm like, how about this third book idea, How Not to Be a D? And he's like, I love it. Let's do it. So it was actually funny how it happened. Even though at the time I thought she was a difficult boss, it actually turned out to be a great thing.
All right. He inspired you. Yeah. With so many situations that you cover, is the book targeted towards a specific age group?
Actually, No, when we first were thinking about doing it, it was going to be 18 and up. But with everything going on with bullying, especially on the internet, and we just felt like it was important to also address things for a younger crowd as well. So we're thinking young adults to new adults would be a great target for this. So it gave us a good opportunity to talk about things like Snapchat or bullying, but then still reference Willow or old Seinfeld episodes. So it gave us a great opportunity to appeal to two different audiences.
Right. Well, since you mentioned bullying, share some pointers on how one should deal with this.
Right. Well, I mean, it's basically the idea in the book is it's the golden rule. You should treat others as you want to be treated. And I feel like if people took some time to understand each other, you know, that it would definitely lessen bullying. And if things like the internet are so difficult, especially when you're a kid, and a lot of us were fortunate not to have access to Facebook and MySpace or Snapchat when you were so young and you're learning about yourself and you're learning about others. So I think it's really important to teach your kids that the internet is the internet and that they should go outside and they should learn empathy and learn talking to someone face-to-face, you know, because a lot of times when you make fun of someone over the internet, you don't see how it makes them feel. So in the book, we talk a lot about understanding people, taking a second and think about how you'd like to be treated, and then also get off the internet for a little bit and actually interact with people and know what you're doing, how it's affecting other people.
Right. And in your At a Party chapter, you write about turning off social media devices, and I could not agree more. What is the polite way to ask a friend to stop texting someone else when you're actually standing in front of them trying to have a conversation?
Yeah, I mean, that is difficult. It is the most frustrating thing. Yeah, if you're trying to talk with someone and you don't have their attention. So I think it's just as simple as saying, you know, when you're texting, it makes me feel like our conversation is important. And I really want to talk to you and I really want to hang out with you. So I think if you tell someone how you feel and you're not aggressive about it, more people will tend to listen to you. No one wants to make the other person feel bad, especially if it's your friend at a party. And some people do it habitually. I know I do as well, and a lot of my friends do. But it becomes like a habit, an addictive habit. So I think it's just reminding your friend that you're there and you want to hang out with them and you care about having their attention, that they would be more understanding and more aware about
right.
putting their phone down.
Right. Okay, so more on parties. You instruct folks to inform neighbors you're planning a party and perhaps even invite them to attend. So
yes.
As a neighbor myself, is there a proper time that parties should end or at least significantly quiet down?
Yes. I believe like if it's on the weekend, I feel like 11 o'clock is when people should be like considerate. And if it's during the week, it should be earlier. I think it's something you should discuss with your neighbors. I think it's incredibly important because maybe your neighbors wouldn't mind if it went to midnight. But yeah, definitely become considerate as it becomes very late, like 11 o'clock on the weekend, 9:30, 10 o'clock during the week.
Let's talk about a, you know, sort of an intimate subject, bathroom etiquette. Is there
yes.
anything you should say or could say to someone who's talking on their cell phone while others are in a public restroom?
That is the worst. Oh, I hate it so much. Yeah, because, unfortunately, when people have to go to the bathroom, they have to go. And if someone's on the phone, it makes them insecure and they have to be in the bathroom longer. So, I saw this happen the other day. And someone was in the bathroom talking on their cell phone, and I asked them politely, I'm like, I'm sorry, I believe other people are in here trying to go to the bathroom. It would be really nice if you could take your conversation into the hallway or downstairs in the lobby. Because it's true, I don't want to be on the phone with my mother and then have the toilet flush.
Exactly.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
Well, what is the right way to deal with a boss that you hate?
Oh, yes, it's very difficult. I feel like open communication is the best answer for a lot of things. And a lot of times people are difficult to work with and it doesn't really have anything to do with yourself. I mean, sometimes it does, but giving a little understanding that maybe they're dealing with an intense amount of pressure or maybe they don't handle pressure or stress very well. So, for instance, when I had my boss that was passive-aggressive, I talked with her and I said, oh, I appreciate it when you speak to me this way, and it makes me feel more motivated and it makes me feel happier as an employee. But when you speak to me in this other way, it makes me feel discouraged and and down about my place in the company. And it made the biggest difference.
Hmm.
So having like a nice, calm, like I'd say first understand why you don't like your boss. And if it takes you writing it down to fully understand why you don't like your boss, I think you should take the time to do that. And then if you find that there is a way you can communicate again with the "I feel this way because it will give you guys both understanding, because people don't want people to hate them. People don't want people to hate coming to work. So I think having an open communication like that, where you're not blaming anyone, you're just telling someone how you feel and how you appreciate certain things and how some things are discouraging, I think it's important.
Hmm. So is there a difference between the way girls and guys have reacted to your book?
Oh, it's so funny, because guys assume that since the D word is in the title, that it's only addressed to men. So, and I find when they read it, they see it's actually really equal. There's a lot of things in the book that you would think stereotypically a guy would do, but I have the girl character doing it, or the reverse. Something stereotypically a girl would do, I have the guy doing it. So they're both sharing like equal weight. So it's funny, because girls don't get the same reaction. They think it's for both. But a lot of guys have thought it was just targeted towards guys.
Right, and talk a little about the book's illustrations.
Oh, yeah. So they're 1940s to 50s inspired. They're kind of an homage to the Dick and Jane characters, where there's a girl character, a boy character, and a dog, which is actually my dog, Polly. But it's like an homage to Spot.
Spot.
And there's simple line drawings from the earlier, inspired by the earlier drawing versions of Dick and Jane. And I want them to be two little characters that reference more recent things and look like they're running around in the book and having fun. There's over 400 illustrations, so people who like line drawings will like that. It's kind of to be a D.
Well, I want to tell the readers that this book was a lot of fun and dealt with a subject that we need to think more about. Thanks so much for joining us today, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All righty. Bye now.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye.
Bye. The Book Report presents a title everyone is talking about: Grain Brain, The Surprising Truth About Wheat, Carbs, and Sugar. Renowned neurologist David Perlmutter blows the lid off a topic that's been buried in medical literature for too long. Carbs could be destroying your brain. Even healthy carbs like whole grains can cause dementia, ADHD, anxiety, chronic headaches, and depression. Dr. Perlmutter explains what happens when the brain encounters common ingredients in your daily bread, why your brain thrives on fat and cholesterol, and how you can spur the growth of new brain cells at any age. The book, written with Kristen Loberg, offers an in-depth look at how we can take control of our smart genes through specific dietary choices and lifestyle habits. Peter Gannon narrates.
I'm here to tell you that the fate of your brain is not in your genes. It's not inevitable. And if you're someone who suffers from another type of brain disorder, such as chronic headaches, depression, epilepsy, or extreme moodiness, the culprit may not be encoded in your DNA. It's in the food you eat. Yes, you heard that right. Brain dysfunction starts in your daily bread, and I'm going to prove it. I'll state it again because I realize it sounds absurd. Modern grains are silently destroying your brain. By modern, I'm not just referring to the refined white flours, pastas, and rice that have already been demonized by the anti-obesity folks. I'm referring to all the grains that so many of us have embraced as being healthful. Whole wheat, whole grain, multigrain, seven grain, live grain, stone ground, and so on. Basically, I am calling what is arguably our most beloved dietary staple a terrorist group that bullies our most precious organ, the brain. I will demonstrate how fruit and other carbohydrates could be health hazards with far-reaching consequences that not only will wreak physical havoc on your brain, but also will accelerate your body's aging process from the inside out. This isn't science fiction. It's now documented fact. It is my objective in writing Grain Brain to provide information that is sound and based on evolutionary, modern scientific, and physiological perspectives. This book goes outside the box of the layman's accepted dogma and away from vested corporate interests. It proposes a new way of understanding the root cause of brain disease and offers a promising message of hope. Brain disease can be largely prevented through the choices you make in life. So, if you haven't figured it out by now, I'll be crystal clear. This is not just another diet book or generic how-to guide to all things preventive health. This is a game changer. Every day, we hear about something new in our various wars against chronic disease, particularly with regard to illnesses that are predominantly avoidable through lifestyle habits. You'd have to be living under a rock not to know that we are getting fatter and fatter every year, despite all the information sold to us about how to stay slim and trim. You'd also be hard-pressed to find someone who doesn't know about our soaring rates of type 2 diabetes, or the fact that heart disease is our number one killer, trailed closely by cancer. Eat your vegetables, brush your teeth, sweat once in a while, get plenty of rest, don't smoke, laugh more. There are certain tenets to health that are pretty commonsensical and that we all know we should practice routinely. But somehow, when it comes to preserving our brain's health and mental faculties, we tend to think it's not really up to us, that somehow it's our destiny to develop brain disorders during our prime and grow senile in our elder years, or that we'll escape such a fate through the luck of good genes or medical breakthroughs. Certainly, we would probably do well to stay mentally engaged after retirement, complete crossword puzzles, keep reading, and go to museums.
On to financial health now. In The Truth Project, Finding the Courage to Ignore Wall Street, Wayne Van Boerstel takes us on an eye-opening journey through the minefield of financial myths. Based on a quarter century of experience as a financial coach and advisor, the author provides alternative strategies based on a foundation of core truths that cut through financial propaganda generated by product marketers. Van Boerstel guides readers through the accumulation, transition, and retirement phases of our financial life, explaining how truths clarify and keep us aligned with our financial objectives. Greg Thomas narrates.
As a nation, we have succumbed to the addiction of relentlessly chasing money and spending it. As bad as this compulsion is, a more ominous danger lies in buying into the castle-in-the-sky vision promoted by the Wall Street marketing machine. Like their counterparts working in the automobile, entertainment, clothing, jewelry, and other industries, those responsible for pushing products at wirehouses, brokerage firms, mutual fund, or insurance companies all have the same assignment: to make their firm skunks look like cuddly kittens. And financial skunks are the worst of the lot, because once you discover you bought one, you can't go back and get a refund or exchange it for something better. Selling the idea that we can become wealthy by buying something that is likely not in our best interest, financial firms prey on our underlying belief that we need wealth to be happy. We have to buy a financial product that will allow us to beat the market, become wealthy, and find bliss. The unspoken, implicit message in all of this is that we cannot be happy with what we already have, because if we believed that, there would be no reason to buy what Wall Street is selling. While behavior modification may help a person recover from spending addiction, the toxic impact of making poor investment choices based on Wall Street marketing or the advice of media talking heads may be irreversible. It's a skunk that moves in and never leaves. We can't all be above average. In addition to the unceasing onslaught of financial pornography, another cause of flawed investment decisions is overconfidence. Most people think they are better at almost anything than they really are. Perhaps the most celebrated better-than-average finding is a study conducted by O. Svensson that found 93% of American drivers rated themselves as being better drivers than the median. Of course, it's impossible for 93% of the drivers to be better than average, so that means at least 43% of the drivers surveyed view themselves as being better drivers than they actually were. It's much the same with investing. Regardless of investment results, most people believe they are smart investors. They explain away poor performance as bad timing or just plain bad luck. Overconfidence is a symptom displayed by the middle class and wealthy alike. The only difference may be the size of their portfolios and the scope of their investment decisions. Similarly, both are vulnerable to spending addictions that prevent them from reaching their financial goals. People can have a high net worth and still not have assets that generate sufficient income to meet their lifestyle requirements. Often, those who earn $100,000 a year live hand-to-mouth and have no savings. They may never have learned how to save or how to deny themselves an extravagance. They may not know how to be content with what they have or know how to invest wisely. Snared in a perpetual financial trap, they are unable to free themselves and move forward. Conversely, there are people who are worth millions of dollars and have a spending addiction or lack a sound financial plan, or both. Despite their wealth, they need more income to support their lifestyle. They choose to live in bigger houses and buy more expensive toys. These people may be no closer to meeting their long-term financial goals than are the struggling middle-class wage earners. The lack of clear financial direction can leave anyone susceptible to stress and uncertainty, particularly when a severe market downturn or unexpected event in their life triggers stressful decisions.
That was The Truth Project by Wayne Von Borstel. Here's a book that could get you moving. Born to Run, The Hidden Tribe, The Ultra Runners, and The Greatest Race the World Has Never Seen is an epic adventure that began with a simple question from author Christopher McDougall. Why does my foot hurt? In search of an answer, McDougall set off to find a tribe of the world's greatest distance runners and learn their secrets. He discovers that everything we thought we knew about running is wrong. Isolated by some of the most savage terrain in North America, the reclusive Tarahumara Indians of Mexico's deadly copper canyons are custodians of a lost art. For centuries, they've practiced techniques that allow them to run hundreds of miles without rest. Their superhuman talent is matched by uncanny health and serenity, leaving the tribe immune to many diseases that plague modern existence. McDougall takes us from high-tech science labs at Harvard to the sun-baked valleys and freezing peaks across North America, where ever-growing numbers of ultra-runners are pushing their bodies to the limit. Readers share that Born to Run, narrated by Fran Sanders, is a rare book that engages and inspires. Let's listen.
For days, I'd been searching Mexico's Sierra Madre for the phantom known as Caballo Blanco, the white horse. I'd finally arrived at the end of the trail, in the last place I expected to find him. Not deep in the wilderness he was said to haunt, but in the dim lobby of an old hotel on the edge of a dusty desert town.
Sí, el caballo está,
the desk clerk said, nodding. Yes, the horse is here. For real? After hearing that I'd just missed him so many times in so many bizarre locations, I'd begun to suspect that Caballo Blanco was nothing more than a fairy tale, a local Loch Ness monstruo dreamed up to spook the kids and fool gullible gringos. He's always back by 5, the clerk added. It's like a ritual. I didn't know whether to hug her in relief or high-five her in triumph. I checked my watch. That meant I'd actually lay eyes on the ghost in less than... Hang on. But it's already after 6. The clerk shrugged. Maybe he's gone away. I sagged into an ancient sofa. I was filthy, famished, and defeated. I was exhausted, and so were my leads. Some said Caballo Blanco was a fugitive. Others heard he was a boxer who'd run off to punish himself after beating a man to death in the ring. No one knew his name or age or where he was from. He was like some Old West gunslinger whose only traces were tall tales and a whiff of cigarillo smoke. Descriptions and sightings were all over the map. Villagers who lived impossible distances apart swore they'd seen him traveling on foot on the same day and described him on a scale that swung wildly from funny and simpático to freaky and gigantic. But in all versions of the Caballo Blanco legend, certain basic details were always the same.
He'd come to Mexico years ago and trekked deep into the wild, impenetrable Barrancas del Cobre, the Copper Canyons, to live among the Tarahumara, a near-mythical tribe of Stone Age super-athletes. The Tarahumara, pronounced Spanish style by swallowing the H, Tarahumara, may be the healthiest and most serene people on Earth, and the greatest runners of all time.
We've just heard Born to Run by Christopher McDougall. Readers, as Taoist master Lao Tzu taught, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. I hope today's show offered up some inspiration on how to take that often difficult first step towards attaining your goals for 2014. If taking more time to read is on your resolution list, make sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. You'll find great titles across the fiction and nonfiction spectrum there. Thanks so much for joining me today. Hope to see you back here next week on The Book Report.